Hi, and welcome to the Future of Dermatology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Farah Kamangar, board-certified dermatologist. We are here to talk about anything and everything dermatology-related. You'll hear from me and my guests, who are dermatologists, physicians, experts, scientists, residents, and medical students in the field of dermatology. We publish weekly, so if you like what you hear, hit that subscribe button and show us some love. And thank you for joining us.
Hello, welcome to the Future of Dermatology podcast. I'm so excited today. We're doing an in-person podcast as opposed to a lot of them that we do kind of far away.
Yeah.
And I'm really lucky to have Dr. Tina Bhutani here. Dr. Tina Bhutani does not need any introductions. We all know her very well in the SF Derm community. She is a fantastic associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and co-director of the Psoriasis Center. The Psoriasis Center name has changed as Psoriasis.
Yes. Now it's a Psoriasis and Skin Treatment Center.
Clinical research still?
No, no. That was probably like 5 years ago. Yeah.
I was just thinking it was 2010 when we were.
Wow.
We started, but you made 2009 even?
Yeah, 2009. Yeah. 14 years ago. Wow. That's crazy. Yeah.
And then so this, episode, we're talking about, of course, the mechanism of action of aryl carbon receptors, so aryl hydrocarbon receptors. So it's kind of funny to think back, because now we kind of know that's also how coal tar works.
Yeah.
And like, thinking about 14 years, all the coal tar we just used to sit in.
Exactly.
So it's going to come all the, you know, full circle. We now have molecules that are kind of not super, like the tar component, they call them kind of like tar safe. We'll talk about tapinarof, which is one of the newer ones. But it's so good to have you here.
Thank you.
And so the main reason that we really wanted to talk about the aryl hydrocarbon receptors, one is it's kind of new to us in dermatology. Minus maybe tar. So I think I wasn't seeing a lot out there about it. So I thought it's good to create some context. And the second piece that was kind of exciting is that they're showing, and I don't want to overhype this too much, but there seems to be some data about longer remissions after stopping. So meaning it's kind of acting on those memory T cells, which is not something we see too often, right?
Right. Especially with topical medications, I think. Yeah.
Those are like the main things. But this needs its own
episode.
Right. And then just looking up like on PubMed, aryl hydrocarbon receptors, there's like over 11,000 people. In all other fields, it's like a hot topic.
Totally. It's
really hot right
now. Totally. Yeah.
Within dermatology, when you add aryl hydrocarbon receptors and dermatology, it's like a little over 300.
Interesting. Wow. So
it's kind of, I think it's like the beginning of the story.
Yeah. We'll probably learn a lot more.
It's kind of been around forever. Lots of different kind of mechanisms of action there. And it kind of really depends on, I think, how the receptor is used. It can be anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, all this good stuff.
Yeah.
But then there's stuff in the literature about if it's used slightly differently, it can kind of have like all this other stuff. So it's just really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think we know that aryl hydrocarbon is a transcription factor, right? And I think a lot of it depends on which ligand it's binding to and in which cells. And that kind of depends on, you know, what the ultimate outcome is going to be. So I think in the skin, we're lucky that we can focus on the use of the aryl hydrocarbon in, you know, our immune cells and in our epidermis and keratinocytes. But then when, you know, aryl hydrocarbon is used in other places, like you said, you know, you can have impacts on other aspects. Yeah. So it's really interesting.
Right. To kind of focus on the mechanism of action. It's kind of, I kind of think about it like the retinoids, where the receptors hanging out on the cytoplasm.
Yep.
And then like tapinarof we'll talk about as an agonist, right?
Right.
And the ligand will come, it'll bind, and then it moves into the nucleus.
Right.
Starts transcribing the good stuff.
Yeah.
I think with the different types of aryl hydrocarbon receptors, how that happens, just even mild differences.
Yes. Yes.
Is like a huge difference.
Where it binds, how it binds, how tightly it binds. So these are all the kind of, you know, intricacies that I think we'll learn a lot more about in the future.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And then I think I was looking at the chemical itself. It is like tapinarof specifically is very similar to even resveratrol.
Oh,
but it sounds
interesting.
Like they actually do completely different things. Huh. Even though they sort of kind of like, are they both
antioxidant? Yeah.
The structure is so similar, but like tiny differences. So
yeah.
I think it's just so interesting, the things that
that's super interesting. Yeah.
Find over time.
Yeah.
So the story of it was, there was this, actually I'll link this publication below the show notes too, but there is one kind of like this 15-year review that one of the authors wrote about, kind of like the story of how they came across.
Yeah, came up with Tapinarof. Yeah.
I have to look it up again to borrow the big words of the name of it. It was like some nematode.
It was a nematode. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So I think they found that there was a nematode that was biting insects or infecting insects. And when those insects died, they found that they were kind of like delayed petrification, basically. So they learned, they're like, wow, this is weird. The insects that were bitten by this nematode end up kind of like decaying slower than the insects that weren't bitten by the nematode. And so these scientists went in to try to find out a little bit more about what was going on. And that's when they found, you know, what is now Tapinarof. I think at that point it was called something else, which was a long scientific name. I can't remember.
Yeah, it's
but yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Microbiome type of thing, this microbe inside
a nematode, right?
Like,
yeah,
again.
I know. I love it. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Total aside, I always think it's interesting with like natural therapies. Like, I don't think people realize in nature, microorganisms and creatures are always trying to like kill the other one for an evolutionary advantage.
So
I do think, you know, the science part is also needed.
Yeah.
Even molecules that are out in nature, these tiny differences can have like a completely different outcome.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Say for science.
Fascinating. Go science.
Go science. We do not know what these things do on a molecular level.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That was the history of it. And I wonder, do you think that's why none of us at the Strizen Center are aging? Just was faster.
We were just inhaling it for so many years. Yeah. 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 We'll see. We'll see. That's funny.
So that's how it started. Years of drug development takes forever. And then psoriasis trials.
I think psoriasis, and I think it went through a few iterations. It was, you know, the studies were started by one company, and then, you know, another company bought it over, and then finally it ended up with Dermavant, where it is now. And then, yes, I think the psoriasis trials were the first kind of phase one, you know, pilot testing that was done by a group in Canada. And then from there on, they immediately saw that even, you know, using it at these crude concentrations was effective for psoriasis, and then these companies went on to develop it. So it's been pretty cool.
I should mention we're doing a three-parter where we're talking about the mechanism first. Actually, the next one I'll ask you a lot more about that, actually, and efficacy and side effects and all the things that they can notice with it. Actually, the third part we'll talk about access, which is always hard. So this one is just really kind of giving attention and time to the mechanism of action of a new molecule. I was kind of looking into other fields. I'm like, what else can we do with it?
Yeah.
So there's definitely work being done. There's even anti-cancer kind of therapies. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about Tapinarof right now, just the aryl hydrocarbon.
Yeah, the mechanism.
Receptors.
Yeah.
And, they're studying in oncology. I saw some really cool trials, and I'm no expert in this. This is like a very superficial receiving of the data, but there's trials where it works on even those clock genes that like affects our sleep.
Yeah, which we know is important for circadian rhythms. I'd love to talk about sleep. I think what we're learning a lot about is that within our immune system, even our immune system has circadian rhythms, and so we know, for example, in the middle of the night, if you check inflammatory markers or check levels of things that we talk about, like TNF-alpha or IL-17, they're oftentimes elevated more in the middle of the night or early morning compared to, you know, evening and other times. So, yeah, so I think we're learning more about how our immune system has a circadian rhythm, the impact of those circadian rhythms on like skin health, but then also skin disease, you know, obviously there's inflammatory skin diseases. So I think we're going to be learning a lot. So when I saw that paper about, you know, aryl hydrocarbon and its impact on circadian rhythms, I thought that was super interesting because I've been trying to find a connection for many years between sleep and the skin.
I mean, that kind of thing is just it's really, we kind of know you should probably get a good amount of sleep.
Yeah,
that's good for you. That's like, you know, something you just kind of generally know about.
Yeah,
I think just finding those molecular
connections. Yeah, so even, you know, a few hours of sleep loss chronically over a period of time can increase, it's like basically a natural pro-inflammatory state. So if you look at like levels of inflammation in someone who's not sleeping, versus someone who sleeps well, there's a stark difference in the like inflammatory factors. And these are in people without even psoriasis. So you can imagine, or inflammatory skin diseases. So you can imagine if you have baseline high levels of inflammation, and then on top of that, you're not sleeping because you're either itchy or, you know, other things are going on. Those levels of inflammation just go up. And my theory is, I think that, you know, that probably makes it tougher to treat. So we shouldn't just be treating the skin. We need to be looking at all the environmental factors that could help us with, yeah, with kind of treating these patients.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot more to come.
Yeah.
How much we should sleep.
Yeah.
And then the other kind of, again, not an expert in this at all, just superficially skimming it, there's a good amount of papers on aryl hydrocarbon receptors with like lipolysis. I think a lot of it was still more like mice model things.
Yeah.
Like that,
yeah.
How it can affect actually the metabolism and fat.
Yeah,
so that's an interesting one, because
we know
the exact connections there are, but like we know
there's an association, right, between psoriasis and obesity and metabolic disease and, you know, things of that sort. So that's that could be super interesting.
So
yeah,
many of these are, a lot of times it's just looking outside of dermatology and seeing what else is
we can kind of learn from,
especially as I find we're getting more and more kind of outside of just skin right now. We're starting to, which is also as a side, should we talk about any updates with what we should be screening for metabolic disease, all the other things, just as a reminder, this psoriasis patient.
I think it's always good to view this patient, psoriasis patient especially, and probably other skin diseases we'll soon learn as well, but the psoriasis patient as kind of a whole patient, right? So yes, we want to treat the skin, but these patients we know, you know, are more likely to be obese, they're more likely to have diabetes, they're more likely to have cardiovascular disease. So even if a simple thing like checking the patient's blood pressure, or if they don't have a primary care doctor, especially, you know, once a year checking a fasting lipid panel, it's not that hard to do. And it could be really impactful for those patients.
Yeah, it's really true. It's funny. In certain instances, like for someone on Accutane, we're checking these things all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. When it comes to like something we're not quite used to, do I want to check this?
Totally. I mean, ideally, you know, in an ideal world, a patient would have a primary care doctor and we could, you know, get them connected, but that doesn't always happen. So I think it's something that we can do easy enough. Joel Gelfand out of UPenn is doing a study looking at these like care coordination centers to basically help dermatologists with things like this. So, you know, if we know a patient is at high risk for heart disease, you know, getting them connected with cardiologists and other care teams can be really helpful.
Perfect. And I'm just kind of thinking last minute things. I'm going to say a mechanism of action before we go into efficacy, things like that. There's just so many cool things I've been seeing. Maybe we'll take an aside to talk about coal tar, even though it's kind of, so the tapinarof and those molecules are kind of like tar safe ones.
Yes.
Because you're taking out maybe potentially some of the.
Yeah. So it's no longer stinky. It's no longer greasy and gross, you know, like it's not like you're putting coal tar all over yourself. Exactly.
I still use tar and I still recommend tar to my patients, but every once in a while you see a patient who's still like, really?
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Right. Well, tar has, I think, you know, tar has over 10,000 ingredients in it. We don't even know all the ingredients that go into tar. And yes, we think probably the main mechanism is through the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, but there's probably a lot of other things going on. That being said, I think the jury has been cleared many, many years ago that tar is totally safe. We are not increasing the risk of cancer. We're not, you know, the FDA has written specific statements saying that it's not a carcinogenic, you know, ingredient. So I think that book has been closed. Yes, that has been debunked.
Kind of comes up, because I still see patients, even if I tell them just use an over-the-counter, for seborrheic dermatitis, just use an over-the-counter tar shampoo, for example. There's a little bit of nervousness.
I mean, I think it gets back to like, it's like a petroleum byproduct, right? And so people are thinking, we get the same thing about Vaseline, right? Like petroleum jelly. And I'm like, it's petrolatum, not petroleum. And so I think it's just, it gets back to those old, you know, tales that we're all used to hearing.
Despite some of those asides, it's really great to establish safety, of course, about something like coal tar. But then I find so much gets focused by public on that kind of thing, where it kind of takes away from the scientific exploration of that molecule.
Yeah.
Like if the FDA and all the scientists could spend a little bit less time over and over again
that it's safe. Yeah.
They could spend that time. Okay, yeah. Let's look at what it's doing to the aerial hydrocarbon.
Yeah.
Teach us about the next molecule and how is it affecting it slightly different than tipifarnib or resveratrol.
Yeah. That's such a good point. And I think that's where kind of, you know, popular culture sometimes gets in the way, right, of our science, because then we have to kind of backtrack and prove that these mechanisms are safe and they're okay before we can then move forward with the science. So, yeah, that could be a whole other podcast episode. Yeah, totally.
Basic scientist. So it's a slow process, right?
Yeah.
Plants, you know, it's not easy. It's just really, I think it's really cool that these more mechanistic studies are being done.
Yeah.
And a more like newer drugs are being put out. I find it's really exciting for psoriasis. Acne, I feel like it's been a little stale, right? Like more of the same thing.
Just in new formulations. But I think, with all the inflammatory diseases, I think we're making a huge impact. I mean, you talked already about the aryl hydrocarbon receptor and the impact on resident memory T cells, which I think was like new mechanistic information that we just got in the last couple of years. And it's interesting because, you know, we talk about remittive effects with coal tar, right? That's one of the advantages of using coal tar is that you treat them and then they stay clear for a long period of time. And I don't think we really understood why that was, but now through the studies with tapinarof that have been done looking at that the aryl hydrocarbon receptor, when you agonize it, it can actually inhibit resident memory T cells and activation of those cells, which therefore, if we don't have memory T cells in the skin, we can keep the skin longer, clear longer. So I think those kind of things are really, really interesting because we learn even through the clinical trials, like what our findings are, and then we can say like, oh, well, why is that happening? And then kind of backtrack and look at it. Yeah.
That's the second thing that was so interesting to me about this was that, so we should spend some time talking about that.
Yeah.
I'll go kind of broader. We always talk about like cure for psoriasis and cure for psoriasis will happen.
Yeah.
And even I'd be curious to see what you think about that as well and how we're moving towards that direction.
Yeah.
But like current state of being, I'm sort of like, we can at least get those T cells to stay away for a really long time.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, like almost once a cure,
it's
good for a long time.
Right.
Not putting something on or green for every single day.
Yeah. I think this came up last year with the National Psoriasis Foundation, the Scientific Advisory Board. There was a lot of talk about, you know, what is a cure and like defining a cure. And, you know, we know a cure is basically you treat someone and their disease never comes back. Remission, like is remission while on treatment truly remission? Because when you think about, you know, when we talk about cancer remission, usually it's like it goes away and they're not on chemotherapy, they're not on treatment, their cancer stays away and therefore they're in remission. But I think in dermatology, I think what we're learning is that remission is probably more kind of like this on treatment remission. Like as long as patients continue to treat, their disease will stay away. And so at this point, I think that's probably the closest thing to a cure that we have, but that's even awesome, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
I'm going to steal that.
Yeah. Remission on treatment. Yeah.
This is probably a tangent as well, but so many patients like get super clear on some of our therapies because they work so long. They're like, I'm doing good.
Yeah. And then it comes back, right?
You know, this is an on treatment.
I literally just had a patient on Thursday. She came in, she has atopic dermatitis. She's doing great. And she was like, so I'm just going to stop my treatment now. And I was like, it's going to come back. And she's like, but I want to try it. And so I said, great. And she literally sent me a message 2 days later saying like the itching in the back, I'm going back on it. So
I understand that too. I probably do the same really.
Totally. Yeah. I know. Yeah. But it's good. It provides hope, you know, like these patients are so hopeful that like their disease might go away. And so
at least when they're on medicine, they can focus on every other part of their life.
Yeah, totally.
Medication.
Totally.
And then so a long time ago, we used to do eczema for to try to kill. Yeah. I mean, we still do eczema, but like in our studies, we're trying to do
blast the T cells. Yeah. Which essentially we were probably doing the same thing, right? I think back then we probably didn't even know about the resident memory T cell at that point in time.
Yeah.
But I think that's what we were doing when we were saying we were blasting the T cells away. We were probably blasting away those resident memory T cells, which is why we were able to get patients clear and in remission for a longer period of time than like regular phototherapy. Yeah. So,
that was some cool results. And minimal blistering dose.
Yes.
Coined by Chris.
Yep. Right? MBD. Chris Titelli. Now Titelli.
Minimal blistering dose, also known as just blast this.
Yes.
As high of a dose as is tolerated.
Exactly.
Yep. To calm the burn.
Calm the burn down. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Literally like one dose, we would kind of hit them with one dose and you would see this like clear area of psoriasis within this larger plaque. It was pretty impressive.
Stay clear for her. And I didn't even joke, like, did we just cure this?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So exactly.
It's exciting to see what, and actually I should also ask, what other therapies in your head do you kind of think about that kind of, my clear one that comes to my head is like when we just blast with.
Yeah. Yeah.
You kind of see is. That kind of
the long-term remission. Yeah. I mean, again, at this point, I think about Coal Tar and I think about Tapinarof. Yeah. I think those are the two kind of, you know, most simple drugs. But again, I think with all of our medications, as long as we continue to use them again, chronically, we're probably making an impact on those resident memory T cells. And I do think that some of the, we talk about the biologics and now, you know, we keep decreasing the frequency of dosing and that's sometimes related to the half life, but not always. So we're probably also kind of impacting the resident memory T cells through those mechanisms, right? That's why we can now go like 3 months, you know, without redosing patients, essentially, because that's, we're probably making an impact on that. Yeah.
A lot of this like detail of science, but are there a lot of studies looking at that and the biologics is what's happening?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually at UCSF, we have a number of investigators that are looking at, you know, the impact on resident memory T cells and maybe even how we can target those resident memory T cells as like our next step in therapeutics. Right. So there's some science going on there and finding like, well, why don't we just kind of directly target those cells, right. Rather than kind of like beating around the bush. Right. Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, there's work going into that. There's also the regulatory T cells, right? That's another T cell that I think doesn't get talked about enough.
Right.
But these are the T cells that are kind of, you know, managing all the other T cells and trying to keep this skin homeostasis, keep things in balance. And so there's a lot of work going on in that realm too, about, you know, how can we make sure those regulatory T cells stay strong and are doing the work that they're supposed to be doing.
That's a good segue into the last question for this.
Yeah.
So it's the future of dermatology podcast.
Yeah.
And we always ask, what do you see happening in the future of dermatology? I think we're kind of talking
about
things, but what is the future of the dermatology department?
Receptor
or the T, you know, memory T cells or T reg cells.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, I do think we're going to have therapeutics that are going to be directly targeting the T regulatory cells. I think they're coming soon. So that's going to be really exciting. And then I would love to see the aryl hydrocarbon receptor mechanism, you know, go one step further. Like, can we give it, you know, systemically? Are there other ways of kind of administering this mechanism of action? I think that would be really awesome. And I think it's coming.
That'd be really fun. Yeah. We could see if we just like never age too.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. Kill two birds with one stone, right?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That ends our first part of this three-part series.
Stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to the Future of Dermatology podcast. Remember to hit that subscribe button and share the podcast with your friends. The more you share and subscribe, the more we'll be able to grow and share our dermatology knowledge. If you have burning dermatology questions, feel free to leave them in the comment below and we would love to address them in a future episode. And please note that this podcast is not intended to substitute for medical advice from your doctor.